Welcome to Dispatch in Depth, where we give you the stories behind the science of emergency dispatch. This is the official research podcast of the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, the world's leading authority in dispatch science. I'm your host, Isabel Gardette, Director of Academics for the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch. In each episode, we'll be bringing you stories of the fascinating people who do research in this area. We'll give you their backstory, including how they got there, what they're working on, and what drew them to the research. These are people who represent the cutting edge in dispatch research, and I hope you'll join us to hear more about them. Welcome to Dispatch in Depth. Our guests today have been in emergency services and public safety for more than 60 total years. Ross Rutschman is a fire and medical program administrator for Priority Dispatch. He's been involved in public safety for over 40 years. And he now plays an integral role in implementations around the world. And Ken Hotelling was a paramedic for 20 years and now is in implementations for Priority Dispatch. And they have helped with implementations around the world, including Hong Kong, Malaysia, Italy, China, Vietnam, Brazil, Lithuania, and the Middle East, among other places. So welcome, Ross and Ken.
Thank you. Good morning.
So the first thing we like to do is to just tell the listeners a little bit about yourself. How did you get into public safety? Why did you continue in this field? And what interests you about it? So, Ross, you want to start?
Well, I got in public safety actually when I started going to college. Where I went to college, the fire department there had a program where you could live there for free. It's a work-study program type of thing. And so I was going to school to be a teacher. And I started enjoying the emergency services. And so I started going to a community college at night to get my EMT and paramedic licenses. And it just so happens that I got a job at a fire department as a paramedic before I got a job teaching when I graduated. So,
what kind of teaching were you going to do?
Health education.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And so what made you stay in the profession?
Oh, I just loved it. Always something different every day. And I was able to also, you know, use my educational background to teach, which was a part of it. You know, and then the schedule, you know, most fire departments had a 24-48 type of schedule, which you can't beat.
And Ken, how about you? What's your background?
It's actually surprisingly similar. I was interested in medicine and so became an EMT while I was going to college to become a math teacher.
Oh, really?
And the college that I was attending messed up my schedule one semester, so I decided to take the paramedic program instead and became a paramedic, loved it, started working with a hospital-based EMS system and moved up through the ranks, becoming the general manager of the service, and it's been a great experience.
That's interesting. I never realized you guys had such similar backgrounds. One of the things that's interesting about the work that you both do now is that you get to go into emergency communication centers around the world and see how they operate. So I think our listeners would be interested in hearing a little bit about what are the differences? What do you see in different places around the world? How do the different centers operate? And then what's the same everywhere you go? Ken, do you want to start?
Probably the biggest difference comes from perception. A lot of times we have to deal with perceptions of, well, in our area or in our country or in our part of the world, people are different. Hmm. And while that's true in a lot of aspects, when it comes to medical emergencies, a heart attack is the same no matter where you are in the world. And so for us, one of the barriers is getting past that, well, here it's different when it really isn't. The other big difference that I see is the public's utilization of emergency services. You'll go to China, a city maybe has 5 million to 7 million residents, but only handles 80 medical cases per day. Hmm. Here in the U.S., a similar size city, New York City, handles up to 1,200 cases a day with the same population. Wow. And so utilization of emergency services is very different based on culture and how they react to emergencies.
And what do you think is the reason for that? Why is there such a low utilization?
Public education is probably the biggest barrier. Public education in Europe, North America has very, very strongly recognized the need for emergency services and has put to the public the benefits of utilizing emergency services. In a lot of these developing nations, you find that there hasn't been any public education. So public awareness of what the capabilities are of the EMS systems, the fire departments, the police, it's just not, the awareness isn't there.
Yeah, and plus, like, if you look at China, if you look at Western medicine versus Eastern medicine, is they're so used to, like, over there, a primary care physician isn't necessarily part of the normal day or the normal life, where we have a personal physician, personal dentist, all that stuff. They don't necessarily have that. And you know, part of the culture is taking care of your elders, and the elders take care of your children. And if somebody actually needs to go to a doctor, they go to a clinic someplace. And then also, prescription medicines isn't a part of the overall typical treatment of family member or patient over there. So it's this whole different, I think, culture of what's an emergency, you know, and what constitutes that.
So do you think paramedicine or emergency medical services is in some ways derived from a Western idea of how medicine works, and so part of it is integrating that into new places?
Well, I don't know if we try to integrate Western medicine. I think, especially with the MPDS, we try to adopt it to their system and then give them maybe some different ideas of how they might utilize their resources, because their resources are not like, I mean, a first responder, it doesn't exist. You know, fire department, police, first responders don't exist typically. You know, so trying to, so you can't try to integrate that because it's not going to happen probably right now.
So that's interesting, because it kind of gets down to that difference between identification and response, because what Ken was saying was a heart attack is a heart attack is a heart attack, and that's true all over the world. But once you've used the system to identify that heart attack, what you send to it, what you do with it might be totally different wherever you are.
Right. In a lot of these areas, they have one type of response. They don't have multiple layers or tiered responses. It's simply, no matter if it's a stub toe or if it's a cardiac arrest, you get the same type of response no matter what. And so that impacts people's likelihood of using it. They see it as, for the especially the lower level emergencies, as almost a waste of a resource, rather than having resources that are more designed for the lower level emergencies versus higher level emergencies. They see it as a waste. And in those cultures, waste is bad.
And is that something that you try to address with them, that you maybe try to encourage or convince them to have different levels of response? Or do you just sort of integrate with whatever they have there?
Well, we generally try to see what their goal of utilizing the system is going to be. For many of them, we're now starting to see, with the increase in access to movies and television shows and things where emergency services are very active, we're seeing that their utilization is going higher and higher, to the point where they don't have resources available any longer. So their concept of why they want the protocol, why they want to utilize a protocol process, is to help them triage, because 30% of the time, 40% of the time, they have no ambulances available. They have no responders available. So they want to make sure that they're sending the responders to the people who need it the most.
And in North America here, we would typically have some mutual aid agreements where you call the next city over to bring ambulances over to help you. And they have no such setup over there.
And do you run into an issue with perception of this as an American system, or does that depend on where you are?
A lot of times we hear that.
Yeah.
But when we sit down with them and explain to them, this is to help you utilize your resources. We're not trying to turn you into a North American model. What we're trying to do is see how we can take your existing model and help you improve it.
And I think we do a good job. I mean, we really try not to. Well, I mean, one thing I've probably learned over the years is that there's many ways to accomplish the same thing. And the U.S. way is just one way. It's not the best. It's not the worst. It's one way. It all depends on what you're trying to accomplish. You know, and there's pluses and minuses based on, you know, with money. You know, one system costs a lot more than the other. You know, and so there's all these things, I think, that come into play. And we kind of just deal with what they, we try to deal with what they have. And it's a long term, it's not a 6 month or 1 year fix. We try to work with them looking at the long term.
Right. And in many cases, what we're finding is the work we do to help them begin the process turns into a development of a national concept of what needs to change within their systems. For example, in China, they don't have EMTs or paramedics. They have doctors and nurses. And every ambulance has a doctor on board. Whether you have a stub toe or you have the heart attack, it doesn't matter. A doctor will always be there. But they have a shortage of doctors. Mm-hmm. So that in turn leads to a shortage of ambulances. So now they're looking at utilizing a mid-level provider like a paramedic. And so we've seen in China over the last 8 years an effort to get the government to recognize paramedic or some similar...
some alternative level.
Right. And to create that level to allow emergency centers to then provide more care, have more units available, have more capabilities to meet the needs of the public.
So it sounds like the implementation of the MPDS isn't sort of its own unit that works by itself. It sounds like it's almost a lever to change or to bring in new concepts for how to perform emergency services in general.
I think that's a fair statement. I think it expands their knowledge and their perception of what's possible, you know, because the MPDS is just kind of one small piece of that.
Right.
Or within the MPDS, you know, with the determinant codes or ECNS, you know, they see it as kind of a beginning module or beginning part of that, the whole process.
Right. And it even gets into with the involvement of the medical directors. And in a lot of areas, we're working with the local health bureaus or health departments. And getting them involved in things like in North America, aspirin is easily available over the counter. In a lot of other regions, it's a prescription medication.
Really?
And so utilizing aspirin in a heart attack is commonplace. We have television commercials in North America saying, if you're having a heart attack, please pop an aspirin in your mouth. In other countries, that's not possible because aspirin is not something that's over the counter. It's not something people have in their household. And in some cases, there's questions about giving aspirin over the phone. Are you acting as a physician prescribing a medication without ever seeing or touching the patient?
Mm.
And so it's getting past some of those types of hurdles when we look at the EpiPen. In the MPDS, if they're having an allergic reaction, we say, grab an EpiPen. Again, those are prescription items and, you know, having someone who's not seen or evaluated the patient physically, but only evaluated over the phone, telling someone to administer a medication is totally different from their previous perceptions or their previous methods of delivering medicine.
Their thought process.
Yeah, it's, you know, looking at this as... oh my gosh, we can't say that over the phone.
Right.
You know, a doctor has to see them before they can receive that medication.
Well, and as possible, the doctors might not even carry that medication.
Right.
I mean, that's entirely possible over there because of the different levels of doctors.
One of the things that you said earlier was that you're trying to figure out what their goal is with the system. So what is your process for that? When you go into a new place, how do you go about figuring out what their goal is? What is your process for understanding the system? There must be a relatively steep learning curve when you go into a new place to understand what it is they're trying to accomplish, meeting all these new people, making these connections. How do you go about doing that? What's the process for breaking down those barriers?
Probably the easiest or most important thing is to listen. We simply walk in on day one and say, describe your system to us. and tell us why you decided to move forward with the protocol process. What were you hoping to achieve?
Yeah, what do you know about the MPD? Tell us what you know about it, because sometimes that's, and I think Ken and I use the both, we both, I guess one of the things is we're very consistent, regardless of which of us was over there, you know? And so that first week we're over there, we have a very definite information gathering process.
Many times, Ross and I work very closely with the clients, and we'll actually have offline discussions between the two of us to say, okay, here's what we're presented. Let's come up with some solutions that may work. And we'll present them with a wide range of solutions of what we've seen around the rest of the world and say, which one sounds like it might work best in your situation?
Hmm. Now, this sounds easy, but we're always working through a translator, of which we never know what they're told. Because some things, as you know, don't translate real well. So we might say something and the translator looks at us funny, like, I don't know how to explain that.
Right. So for the translators, having context is important. Yeah. And sometimes when we have a translator who doesn't come from a medical background, who doesn't come from an emergency services background, who doesn't come from an area where emergency services are frequently used, we struggle to give them context so that when they translate, the message is the same.
So you have to educate the translator first before they can educate the
operator. And sometimes even the agency. So one of the questions we'll ask in China, which would be very familiar here, is how many calls do you have a year? How many calls do you have a day? Okay, we know we're talking about EMS responses, fire responses, they'll tell you how many phone calls they get a day. Not related to, it's all phone calls. Mm. Not emergency, right. Non-emergency. So you can't use you can't say how many calls. You know, how many times do you need to dispatch an ambulance per day?
Right. How many requests did you get for an ambulance?
Mm. Yeah.
You know, in some areas of the world, as the emergency numbers become published and as they start public education campaigns, there's a lot of prank calls. There's a lot of misuse. In one area, they estimated that 90%+ of the calls coming into the emergency center were prank calls, hang-up calls, people just testing to see if it actually worked, who answered the phone. They didn't have real emergencies.
Yeah. Huh. In Malaysia, they would receive about 84,000 calls a day to their 999 centers, and I believe out of that, only like 6,000 to 7,000 are actual emergencies. Please, and that encompasses all facets of public safety, not just medical.
And how are they handling that?
They answer every call.
And they try to screen for whether it is an emergency or not. The other thing that they do is, after you receive 5 prank calls from the same number, they'll actually block that number. Which sounds harsh, but when you're dealing with 83,000 prank calls a day, you have to do something to manage it because it's overwhelming.
Well, it sends it into a recording.
Right.
If this is an actual emergency.
Right.
Yeah.
And
so it kind of blocks it.
It blocks it from the dispatcher. It doesn't block it from receiving aid.
Hmm.
Yeah.
It does still offer an opportunity, but.
And do you think that's something that will become less common as they get used to the number?
Well, here in North America, the way that agencies have dealt with it is, if it's a prank, you send an officer to go talk to that person and say, you shouldn't be doing this. But in a lot of other areas of the world, they don't have the ability to do that because you have temporary SIM cards. There's no registration of people's home address. There's no registration of even who the owner of that number is.
So is there an approach to managing this? Do you think it's something that they'll be able to get under control, or do you think this is just sort of an endemic problem?
I think with public education, and if they tailor their public education more to the detractors of those prank calls, what's happening when there's a prank call? What are you taking away from people who have real emergencies? I think as they educate the public that, you know, those are things that are real concerns, it will go down a little bit. Is it going to solve all of it? Probably not.
I just want to change tack for a minute here and ask about a study, Ross, that you're working on. You're interested in heart attacks, also known as STEMIs. So what is that study and how'd you get involved in that?
Well, so you know, I worked as a paramedic for, I'm still a paramedic, but it was something that always interested me. So back in, you know, like in the late 90s, I'm aging myself, but I took a 12-lead instructor course, which kind of got me interested in diagnosing STEMIs. And then we've been using the MPDS since 1989, where I had worked. And so it was just kind of something that when I came over to Priority Dispatch full time, is something I was really interested in. And where I had worked, we had implemented a STEMI protocol where we, because our nearest chest pain center was an hour away, within our STEMI protocol, we used a helicopter to transport patients to the chest pain center. Mm. And so from that, then I kind of started, I wondered, are there certain determinant codes that could predict a STEMI that would help with resources, help decide when we would maybe alert a helicopter that we might need them, and which ones do we need a first responder on, which ones don't we, that sort of thing. And so that's kind of where it evolved from my thinking. And then I got involved with the Heart Rescue Project in China 2 years ago. And from there, I started wondering about, and over there, chest pain centers are real new. And so the thought came up of, do people in other countries have the same sort of symptoms? What would their determinant, what would their MPDS codes be compared to somebody in North America?
Hmm. And do they have the same symptoms, or do they describe the symptoms the same way, or both?
Well, I think over there, so part of it is, you know, obviously through translators, you know, and so that's why I think one of the things where this study will help is because we'll get people talking Mandarin, people talking to people that talk Mandarin, so we'll get good codes. But some of the things Ken and I think frequently hear are, my father or my husband's heart is uncomfortable. That would that's be a typical thing. I mean, we're not sure quite what uncomfortable means. So we're wondering, how are those things coded?
Right, and that becomes important in chief complaint selection. Right. Is uncomfortable his heart is racing, or is uncomfortable that he's having pain or pressure? Is uncomfortable that he just has indigestion? What does uncomfortable mean?
Right.
And unfortunately, we haven't been able to get a good answer up to this point.
Right. So we're real curious to see where do those, how do those calls, some of those calls get coded that end up being a STEMI, you know, at the hospital?
And I think, if I remember correctly, that you're interested in doing this study, not just in China, but in other places as well. What's the reason for that?
Well, because we're looking at if there was any cultural difference. So while we, you know, thought about China, we also thought about, well, you know, how do people in Western countries, you know, that are more Western, you know, because your diet's different than the Asia, you know, so how do people in Western countries describe heart problems? And then we also, so we have three continents, basically. We have China, where we have two sites basically doing it. We have Hamad Medical Center in Doha, Qatar. And they're an accredited center. And the interesting thing about there is they have a whole variety of, you know, they have Middle Easterners, they have people from India, a lot of Indians working there. And they have a lot of people from the UK, Australia, so Westerners. Okay, and then we have Montgomery County, Texas, which is also participating. Mm-hmm. So we think between those three sites, not only are we going to get a good cross-section of coding, but we're also looking, one of the questions that we're looking at is, what cultural background do they have?
Mm.
You know, to see if there's any differences there.
You're interested then in seeing whether they describe heart attack symptoms differently culturally, and and how we can better identify those through the MPDS so we can capture them?
Right, yeah. And so that agencies, and I think, you know, as we grow in Asia, resource management there is going to be more important. Their use of chest pain centers. They don't have a lot of chest pain centers. And now some places over there, some areas are starting to use helicopters that they're just, that's kind of a new thing. So it might help them decide which patients go to the chest pain center, how do they go to the chest pain center, that sort of thing.
And from being involved in this research, what has that given you, this experience of being involved in a research study? Has that given you any new insights or new ways of thinking about public safety and emergency medicine that isn't quite the same perspective as being in the field?
Well, just this is my first time doing research. It's been a much more complicated process than I ever thought it would be. And it probably doesn't match my personality real well.
Why do you say that?
I'm more of a, you know, draw the study up, let's go do it. Mm-hmm. You know, and yeah, so that's why Ken and I work well together because, you know, sometimes I have, he's detailed oriented. So sometimes I'll come up with ideas. He puts it, he makes these forms and he puts these things in writing, you know. And so this has been good for me because it's been a very, very good learning experience. And I have a whole new appreciation for people that do research because I did not know it involved so much.
I actually love that you said that, though, because one of the things we hear from a lot of new researchers and a lot of experienced researchers is that developing a partnership among people who have different skills is vital, just as it is in consulting or any other work. And so to hear you say that you have some of the skills and then Ken has some other different approaches, that's what we hear even from people who have done research for a long time, that you just can't do it by yourself. It's not a one-person activity.
No. I mean, I think we have a great working relationship because we'll sit down. We have a free day someplace together, and we'll sit down and we'll bounce. I mean, we're working on the same things kind of, but we'll bounce. We'll both have different views of this, whatever it is, you know?
Right. So the way that I look at the way that Ross and I work together is Ross has the dreams, mm-hmm. and then I try to bring it into reality. Of what we can do and what's possible. But you have to always have those dreams. You always have to have somebody reaching further. You know, like Russ said, we spend time maybe on a weekend in Beijing. We'll sit down and run through some ideas and try to come up with some solutions of how to help move things forward.
That's actually a great description of research, that you have to have this big idea or insight or question that you're trying to ask first, but then, like you're saying, you actually have to make it fit into a methodology and a process that makes it standardized and usable for other people, generalizable, rather than just, we found something in this place or we found something in that place. That's actually a very good description.
Yeah, and so we're also part of the advanced solutions team here at Priority Dispatch. And so that, I think, a lot of what we do, a lot of that partnership flows over into that with some of our assignments there.
So what is advanced solutions?
We look at the way that we've presented protocol to clients over the years and try to improve on how we can help with understanding, how we can help with improved performance.
And processes.
Processes, documentation, and then how do we deliver that better to the client? So that, you know, they can achieve their goals quicker, more efficiently, more effectively.
So we teach our dispatchers and our queues to do quality improvement, but we do quality improvement on ourselves and our own processes as well, is what you're saying.
Right. Right. You know, we're always striving to improve how we deliver our products. And that's really what Advanced Solutions is looking at, is how we can take what we've historically done, make it better, and make it more relevant for the clients and help them improve.
Right. And then we've also got one of the areas we're looking at is if somebody has, maybe a client has struggled for a long time and now they, you know, maybe they've changed management or something and now they want to, and they've used the, let's say, MPDS for 15 years or 10 years. Now suddenly they want to do it right.
Yeah, they want to revisit the way that they've historically managed the process. Mm-hmm. It's been 10 or 15 years since anybody's been there to really help them with that implementation. Yeah. And so it's going in and saying, okay, let's look at it with a fresh eye.
Yeah. Where are they now? Where do they want to be? And how do we move them there?
You know, one of the challenges that we face when we implement in a new center is once they are successfully using protocol, how do we get them to continuously strive to change and improve and be better? And so that's really another one of the things that Ross was talking about is 10 years later going back in and saying, so have you continued to move forward or are you stuck? And if you're feeling like you're stuck, how can we help you move forward?
So one last thing before we go, I'd like to ask both of you, which is from all of your experiences around the world with all these different agencies, where do you see the future of emergency communications? What are going to be the new challenges and opportunities in the next 10 or 20 or 30 years?
Now, from a medical standpoint, it's probably easier because I don't have a real police, but I think it probably holds true for police, is that the emergency call center is going to be a real triage point for all types of calls. You know, because more and more people have trouble accessing healthcare. You know, they don't have a primary care physician, or if they do, you can't get into one. And when they get into problems, is they're going to call 911. And I think that we have to educate agencies, I think, at what point has their system absorbed all it can absorb, and they need to look at real triage. You know, actually looking at their resources and looking at a different way to do business. And you know, one of the things I always try to educate agencies like in North America is what we tend to do, and this is just my thoughts, what we tend to do, we tend to associate a paramedic with a piece of equipment. A paramedic's got to be on an ambulance. You got a paramedic and they're on a fire engine. You know, so we always associate, oh, we need to send a paramedic to this call, so it's got to be this ambulance or fire truck. And I think people have to get away from that, is looking at, we need a type of care for this patient, but is this something one person can do? Yeah, what are the probability of transports? Because there are many of these calls, you know, you could look at, you know, all the codes in the MPDS, and I don't know what percent, but there's probably a high percent that one person go out and take care of that person, you know? And so I think that's something agencies have to look at is triaging, you know, and I think that's where we're going, but it's a change of paradigm.
Right. And that's from the response side, looking at community paramedic systems and looking at telehealth systems and things like that. And that'll have an impact in the dispatch center where we might see the doctor being in the dispatch center to facilitate that telehealth or that community paramedic program to help deliver care through an intermediary at the scene. So send one person out, but one doctor could have 10 community paramedics out treating 10 patients simultaneously.
With iPads and video.
Right, video, telemetry. Yeah. And so that's one aspect of it. For the dispatch center itself, you know, all the new communication technologies that are out there, getting emergency requests through social media, getting it through SMS, getting it through video, video links. So I think those are going to be challenges with technology in the dispatch center, is if somebody is sending you a video of a crime in progress, how do you now translate that into what we've historically done through questioning? You're now visually getting that information because maybe they can't speak because they're poking their cell phone around the corner and giving you live footage. How can we deal with that? And how can we assimilate that type of information into the dispatch center and make good response decisions based on those new emerging technologies? You know, as we look at artificial intelligence systems, somebody says to their phone, "Hello, phone, I am having chest pain. What should I do?" Well, maybe the phone is going to generate an AI call to the emergency center saying there's a person with chest pain at these coordinates, because it's going to use the location services on the phone. And maybe you're not talking to a human. You're actually talking to an artificial intelligence on the phone itself. And meanwhile, while that's happening in the background, maybe the phone is also telling the caller through artificial intelligence, take an aspirin right now, get to the lowest floor of the building, so that, you know, emergency services will be able to find you. Developing those types of responses and those types of concepts are going to become important in emergency services. How can we move forward with the advances in technology? And technology is moving much faster than emergency services can react to.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ken and Russ. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Dispatch In Depth. Remember, it really helps us if you rate and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. Dispatch In Depth is hosted by me, Isabel Gardette. Our producer is Becca Barris. Reading Roberts is the technical director, and Scott Robinson is our executive producer.